You are listening to Steve Janowski's Review Fix Rocktologist Podcast. Enjoy the ride.
Taking the time, I really appreciate this.
No, it's nice to talk to you, man.
Great. Now, the website was redesigned. I've looked at it, and why?
It's a lovely site.
It sure is.
And, of course, what it reflects, of course, is the people who did it. You know, they're just lovely people. Really sweet and absolutely, you know, committed. Wonderful.
Yeah, they did a great job with it. I've navigated. I looked at the discography section. There's a very interesting radio interview on there, and I think it's very well done.
I think, you know, it's very early days because we've only just launched it. And, of course, you know, all the tidying up really hasn't been done. But in essence, I think it's a very nice site. It's clean. It's clear. And what I'm most interested in, to be honest with you, is the communications aspect of it.
Right, the interaction.
You know, what it is that I decided some while ago to get more proactive in communicating with people. This was partly selfish from the point of view that, well, of course, you know, it's better for promotion and that kind of thing. But on the other hand, I actually really enjoy communicating with people who've been with me all my life.
Right.
The other day we did this chat online. It didn't last very long.
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah.
Well, the server went down.
Right. Right. Okay. You're doing another one on the 20th. Is it the 22nd?
Well, no. Here's the thing.
Okay.
What happened was the server went down, and we didn't know how many people were actually. We knew how many were in the chat room. It was 300 were in the chat room itself.
Mm-hmm.
But what we didn't know was how many were trying to get in.
Wow.
Okay, so we don't know that number. It could be 50, it could be 500, but we just don't know.
And it can only handle so much. That's how it goes.
The server we were using could probably only handle 250. And when it got to 300, it just stopped, you know. So that was a bit of a problem. But in terms of what we're going to try and do next time is we're going to try and do, you know, we'll turn the level up to, say, 500, and we'll see if that, you know, that works. If that crashes, we'll have to turn it up to 1,000. If that crashes, we'll have to, you know, until we reach the ceiling.
Well, that's
honestly don't know.
But that's a good thing.
It is good. Except the only thing is, people get frustrated if they come online. They want to ask a question. That's all they want to do is ask their question.
Right.
They try and do it, and then they can't do it.
Right.
So the thing is, we're trying to get it right, you know.
Yeah. Did you enjoy it?
That's new technology.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, you know, as I said, there's one aspect to it, which is, of course, it's useful because you could promote your latest record or whatever you want. But the thing I really enjoy about it is I actually enjoy talking to the people that have been fans for years and especially from strange places, you know. You have people ask from Moscow and just these, you know, Budapest and these out of Romania. These places that you never got to play and they so desperately want to talk to you.
That's so nice.
And it's just a lovely feeling to be able to speak with them. So that's the other aspect of it for me.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
But it's set up for another one, or you're not sure at this point?
Right now we are setting the machinery up to try another one.
Okay, and the date will be on the website, I guess you'll...
We had planned to do it next Sunday, but what happened, to be truthful with you, is the guy who does all our computer programming got hit with the swine flu.
Oh, my God. Wow.
Yeah, so brave soul that he was, he kept going, and he set the thing up in motion, and what we're doing is without him now, because he's really ill, but without him, we are just proving it, testing it. And so as soon as we're ready, what we'll do is we'll announce another day. It'll probably be, you know, Wednesday next week, because of his absence. But, you know, that's when it'll be, and we'll have another go.
Okay.
But don't put that in your interview, because otherwise they'll all log on then. But
no, I won't.
We're
do
hoping.
That.
I'm just telling you. We're hoping to do it next Wednesday, and then what'll happen is, as soon as we're sure, we'll post it, and then we'll do the interview, and hopefully. But you see, even then, we don't really know if it may crash again, because we just don't know how many people are coming online.
Wow. But some people did get to ask some questions. I mean, you did get some.
They did. They did, yes.
Yeah.
It went up, according to the computer guy, we started off at sort of 50, and it was fine. We were answering questions, and they were, you know. And then it went up to sort of 100, and we were still asking, then 150. Got up to sort of 250.
Wow.
And then it started crashing. And that meant that 250 people were simultaneously asking a question.
Is a certain time allotment for this that you're setting aside? I mean,
well, yes. What we did is we worked out the best sort of global time, which was sort of 10 o'clock GMT, London
right.
time, so that it would be able to spread across the most of the time zones.
Okay, great.
But to be honest, there were people who were sitting up all night. There were people in Australia calling in. And it was really bizarre. Do you know the strangest thing about it, Steve? I'll tell you what it was. He's sitting here online, you know. You get the strangest feeling of, you know what the word cyberspace?
Yes.
Well, you know, it's a word, that was just a word to me.
Right.
Cyberspace is just a word to me. But when I got online and I could feel these people coming from Moscow, Japan, all these places, that really did feel like cyberspace.
Yes.
It really did feel like something that I hadn't quite experienced. You know, I tell you, I've played to audiences with ELP of anything up to 600,000 people.
You're talking about the Isle of Wight Festival, was that?
No, that was, I think the Isle of Wight Festival was 250,000.
Right, okay. Wow.
The biggest one, I think, was California Jam.
Oh, I was just going to, yes, California Jam, right.
But I think that was 600,000.
So yes, yes.
I have looked into the eyes of 600,000 people. I'm one of the few people on Earth who's looked into the eyes of that many people. And of course, it's a strange experience. I mean, to be honest, the bigger it gets, in a way, the less you are aware of it, because it starts to become just a grey mist, you know?
Right, right.
You know?
That's
but in the, when you're on the internet and you feel people from other continents, you somehow feel it in a strange way. You feel this global, you feel a global awareness.
I agree. That's a great point.
And it's one of the great things, I think, about the internet. There are a lot of bad things about it. I mean, the way it spreads things like, you know, paedophilia and all these
yes.
awful things that it does. But on the other hand, the great thing about the internet is it does bring people together. And there's a sense of community. And I believe this is really important in things like global warming or, you know, things that matter to us, to the real people of the world. It is a way of communicating where it could be the thing that saves the planet. You know, it just could be
yes.
the one thing where we used to take positions and one government would take up weapons and start war with another government. But the internet could be the thing where the people actually start to control the issue rather than letting governments get out of control and start warring with each other.
That's a great point. If people take
it could be
it in,
great.
Yes.
You think about it. It could be great, right?
Yes, if people organize in that way through cyberspace. That's an excellent point.
You see what I'm saying? So, you know, I mean, I saw something funny. There was a funny sketch I saw last night on the television. You know, President Obama, God bless him, had visited China. And, of course, there was this funny sketch about, you know, when Obama went onto the Chinese television, and he went to do his usual talk into a student forum. And he would say to the students, you know, they would ask questions. I say, well, you know, what do you think is great about the internet? He'd say, well, wonderful thing about the internet is it allows free speech, you know. And then they would have this funny cartoon, and what it would be is the Chinese television would sort of interrupt the program and say, I'm sorry, there's been a technical fault. You know, you know, Mr. Obama is actually not appearing here tonight. Please carry on making your kitty doll toys or whatever it was, you know. And so there was a funny skit.
That's
down on
great.
But you know,
so true.
That's the truth about it.
So
the
true.
Truth about it is, it informs every human being. If you can get on the net, you're informed.
Sure. It can.
And what that is, I'll tell you what that is, basically, that's world government.
You're saying it could affect world government.
I'm saying it is world government.
Oh, it is. You're saying the internet...
By proxy.
By proxy.
It is world government. It means that you and I...
That's true.
We're in different countries. But you know, when it came time to choose the President of the United States, I was supporting President Obama from here actively.
Mm.
I was writing to all my friends in America saying,
right.
Please get behind this guy.
Yes, yes.
Please get behind him because he's the only hope we got.
Exactly. Very
right,
good point.
Right, so I was taking my part in that election, even though I couldn't vote because I'm not a citizen. But I sure as hell got behind him. And when he got voted in, there were tears in my eyes.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I mean, it was definitely needed.
Well, it was needed, and the thing was, though, it was the internet that made that possible, really.
Yeah, it's incredible. Hey, it brought you and I together today through your publicist.
There you go.
And
see?
So I think that's an amazing thing, too. It really
yeah.
is.
So there's a very long answer to a very simple question about my website.
It's a great answer, by the way. One of the, probably the best answer I've ever gotten.
You'll never get a better one.
That's true. That's a great start.
But you know, it is, I believe it is the beginning of a world government, of a world census, because now the issues are global. Now the game is, our dicks are all on the table. You know, if we do not respond to the global warming and global conditions, we're all going to suffer.
That's right, and we can
we're all going to suffer,
and we can circumvent governments who aren't acting properly or
precisely,
in our best
precisely.
Interests.
That's
an excellent point. Very enlightening.
I'm absolutely
point.
Right. Is that I can talk to someone probably in Burma.
That's
or
right.
Or perhaps the other way around. Someone in Burma can probably talk to me. And they do, you know. I get calls from people and messages from people. I'm not saying I had one from Burma, but I get messages from people from very strange places and very strange circumstances, making different, you know, pleading different cases and pleading different things, and they want to be heard, and they want their story recognized by someone. I mean, in this case, it's someone who they admire for songwriting, or that they like an album, or this or that.
Right.
But I mean, in the same way, it affects. It's all across the board, I think.
Very nice. Excellent.
Yeah.
Great point. Really wonderful. The big buzz, though, in my circles, is about you playing with ELP at the High Voltage Festival in England.
Yes.
And that's happening next summer, or when is that
yes.
exactly? July, I've heard.
I think it's July the 25th, if I'm not wrong.
Right. And you're writing songs with Keith Emerson again.
Yes.
Which is just so exciting for all of us, and... is there a chance that this will lead to something more substantial?
I believe it will.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I believe it will. It's a strange thing that for many years, ELP were... We never really broke the group up in the sense that we always owned our own copyright. So we always shared this sort of business together.
Right.
We always shared this legacy together.
Oh, definitely.
And But, you know, for a long time, Keith and I were, I suppose the word is, estranged, you know.
But it's like, but with good feelings probably still there, right?
Well, yes, I believe, you know, it's like a family. I've got to tell you, it's like a family. You can fall out with your best brother, with your blood brother. It's possible to fall out with people.
Yes.
And even in your own family. And all of a sudden, you reach a point in your life, and you turn around and you think, what the hell am I doing? This is my family. These
right.
are the people I love, you know. And I think that in the case of Keith and I, we reached a point, both of us, in our life, where we just looked at each other and thought, my God, you know, I've just spent the last 20 years without the most important person in my creative life.
Right, you shared so much together.
Yeah, we shared so much together, and we created the best things that we ever did, we did together. And I think that there was a moment for him and me when that became clear.
Right.
And it was a most amazing thing. It's strange, you know, I haven't talked to Keith about how we're going to talk about this in the press.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that he would be happy for me to say that we reached a point where we really sat back and looked at each other and thought, you know, wow, I really respect what that guy is and what he created and the power of his creation and the effect that it has upon me.
Right, that's
and
wonderful.
And we both felt that simultaneously. And what we decided to do was to start writing together again.
Is it any different than writing in the past?
No.
No, I would assume it's like wearing a very comfortable shoe that you've worn before, you know?
It is obviously a different perspective.
Right.
Here we are at the other end of our lives, you know?
Sure.
And so there is a different tone to it in a way, but it's exactly the same chemistry.
That's wonderful.
It's exactly the same chemistry. When he and I play together, there is something. You can't put your finger on it. I can't put my finger on it. I don't think anybody could. It is just an understanding, a sensitivity, a chemistry, if you will, that is unusual, arresting, different.
Yeah, it can't be duplicated, really.
No.
So, and was that from the very beginning? I mean, when you first
it
met
was.
Up?
It was. You know, it's funny. I felt it a few times because, you know, we would sometimes just assemble ELP. I remember when we made the Black Moon record.
Mm-hmm.
We assembled the band to do that. And I remember going into the rehearsal room. And to me, it was just a project at that time, you know. And we went in and we set our gear up and we all met up. And it was 11 o'clock and that was, you know. And we all went into the room and said, well, what should we play then? Just to get going, you know. So I think Keith said, well, let's play Fanfare. We all know, you know, let's just play through Fanfare.
Right.
And we started, and it was like the hair on the back of your neck would stand up.
Yeah.
All the roadies in the room, you could see they were shocked by the power of the band.
Yes.
And the power was not the volume, it was the intensity of emotion.
Right.
It was just a stunning moment when you would feel the energy of these three individuals come through their instruments, not in volume, not in loudness, but in sheer power.
Yeah.
And there's a funny chemistry which happens with ELP. I've seen it too, by the way. I played bass on the last Who single.
Right, I was going to ask you about that, right, yeah.
Good-looking,
really good-looking boy.
When you
really
work with Pete and Roger,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. You see that same chemistry.
Yes. Despite the fact that it's always said that they, you know, have some problems getting along here and there, but it
oh, no, they do.
Yeah.
It's not like they get on well together.
But that doesn't take that away.
No. It's rather like, I don't want to talk about Pete and Roger going into that, but, you know, it's rather like you see some marriages where people, they don't really get on, but on the other hand, it's a magical relationship.
Right. That's a great...
It's quarrelsome in a way. It's quarrelsome and it's highly charged.
That's right.
But in a sense, they both need each other.
Ah, that's a great analogy. Yeah.
You know, and it's dependent. One is dependent upon the other. And it's because of that chemistry that it strikes up this energy. And it's the energy which is the who. And even without Keith Moon, you know, it still manages to, you know, light up an arena.
That's great.
And it is that energy between Pete and Roger that does that.
Oh, excellent. Very good point. And so I was just going to actually ask you that. You work with Roger Daltrey. How did that collaboration come about? You'd known them a while? This is a...
To be honest, I was friendly with the man who owns a newspaper in England called the Daily Express.
Mm-hmm.
And a magazine called OK Magazine. I believe you have that.
Yes, I've seen that, yes.
The owner of that is a man called Richard Desmond.
Mm-hmm.
And Richard is a friend of mine, and Richard is a big supporter of the Teenage Cancer Trust. He donates a lot of money to that charity. And one year he asked me to play bass for the charity for a concert. And it was with Roger. And so I came in, I played bass, and of course Roger and I knew each other from the old days,
oh, sure.
You know. And so that's how I got involved with the Who, really, through Roger.
And that's the charity for missing children?
No, it's for teenage cancer.
Teenage cancer. Okay, because I was going to talk to you about the other charity. That's wonderful. So getting together for that cause and playing great music too. In addition, you were a member of Ringo Starr's All-Star Band. What was that experience like? Was it a positive experience?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
No, you know, right. Yeah. When you play with Ringo, it's a funny thing. It's a, you know, because he's a funny guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like having lived the life I lived makes me a fairly extraordinary person, you know.
Definitely.
Because no one lives that life, really.
Right.
It's an incredible diversion from normality.
Yes.
You know, flying every day on a Learjet and then bling, bling, and... You know, performing in front of hundreds of thousands of people and all of this, you know, although to be honest with you, it is not quite the life it seems.
Right.
Because very soon you develop almost an immunity to the adoration and, you know, it's not all roses. It's, you know, touring is hard.
Sure.
There are aspects of being in a band that are hard.
Yes.
And, yeah, it's psychologically very complicated as well. But when I look at my scenario and then I compare it to Ringo's, you know, I'm like a 100th of what he went through.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. He lived in his
fishbowl. You know, that was the Beatles.
Sure.
And they went from... I mean, Ringo told me a story one night. We used to sit on the jet at night. We always used to fly at night with Ringo. He used to like to travel between shows. We would fly right after one show, and we'd fly through the night to the next show, and we'd wake up in the morning, and we were already at the next place, you know. It was quite a smart way to do it.
Yeah.
And at night, Ringo would always come, and he'd sit on the edge of my chair, and he would sit around, and there'd be me and Sheila E.,
mm-hmm.
Howard Jones.
Right.
And he would tell stories, you know. And everybody, of course, would love to listen to Ringo's stories. But Ringo mainly liked to talk about before the Beatles happened.
Ah.
That's what really... When Ringo looks back on his life, he doesn't really look back much on the Beatles. Mm. He likes to look back pre-Beatles.
Well, he played with Rory Storm and the Hurricanes, I remember reading.
Yes, Rory Storm... And his biggest idol was Johnny Ray.
Uh-huh.
And that's the really interesting stuff. And I think the reason is he's been asked so many Beatles questions.
Sure.
He's just sick of talking about it, you know. But sometimes he'll wander into the Beatles, you know, just by the by, he just wanders into a story. And he told me a story one day. He said, you know, he said, people don't understand really about the Beatles, but he said, on the last day of the Beatles ever played, we still didn't have our own hotel room. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, we used to share rooms. It would be two guys to one room.
That's
funny. To the very last show. And I said, well, why did you do that? And he said, well, we always did do it. He said, because, like, in the beginning, when we used to travel around England, it was bed and breakfast, you know. And they would always book it, two guys to one room, two guys to one room. They used to shift around who stayed with who. So it wasn't like, you know, Paul would be with John every night or Ringo would be with George every night. They would swap who stayed with who on a sort of rota basis. But they always used to share a room together right until the last gig.
Wow.
And it staggered me. And he said, yeah, we only ever had two roadies. Two roadies. There is ELP with 55 road managers.
Oh, wow.
You know, this three-piece band traveling with this massive entourage.
Well, especially when you had... Yeah, but when you had the orchestra, too, I'm assuming. That was
140.
Oh, my God.
Right?
Yeah.
And there's Ringo, through the entire career of the Beatles, two roadies.
That's great. Great story. I interviewed Simon Kirk a while ago. He said he had a wonderful experience playing with him, too, you know, on one of the all-star bands.
Yeah.
Great.
He's a very, I mean, humble person.
He seems, he comes across that way in interviews, so I must, yeah, so he really is like that, yeah.
I mean, in one way he's humble, but on another way, you know, he told me a story where he went into some concert that they had with, you know, the sort of all-stars got to play, and he said he went up on stage, there was Eric Clapton on guitar, Elton John on piano, it was one of these sort of huge... huge, you know, superstar get-togethers, and he said, I didn't like the sound of it. He said, I just got off the drums, and I walked away. You got to be Ringo to do that, you know? Leave Eric standing there, you know?
That's a great story.
You're going to laugh, haven't you?
Great story.
Isn't that beautiful? What a beautiful story.
That's wonderful.
I didn't like it. I didn't like the way it was sounding. You know?
Excellent. In recent years, as mentioned on your website, that you were involved in a number of recording projects. One was in Rochester, I think, and one was with an orchestra in Weimar, Germany. I was going to ask you, was there a particular reason why these projects didn't come into fruition? You know, why did...
Rochester, I just happened to have a lot of friends in Rochester.
Okay.
Upstate New York. There was a place called the House of Guitars, and there was a man called Andy the Buick. And Andy, his name's spelled B-A-B-U-I-C-K.
Thank you.
And Andy used to work at the House of Guitars, and Andy and I used to know each other, we were good friends. One day, Andy wrote the book, it was called Beatles Gear. And it's the encyclopedia on the Beatles equipment.
All the equipment.
It's a fabulous book.
Wow.
I recommend it to anybody. It's like an encyclopedia of the equipment the Beatles used to use. Huge book. It's really authoritative. And it was done with, it was done with Apple and with the Beatles approval. I was a close friend of Andy's, and so that was my Rochester connection. The Weimar thing was different. What happened with Weimar is that it was the Franz Liszt University, and the students there were interested in classical adaptations. And the reason was because out of every 1,000 students that graduate, maybe 4 or 5 get jobs in the top orchestras.
Wow.
You know, that's all.
That's amazing.
You know, it's very few people get taken up by the top orchestras. Once you've got a job in an orchestra, you join the Berlin Philharmonic, and you're a fiddle player, you're there for life.
Yeah.
You're there for life. So it's not, you know, these places to join these orchestras are very rare. So most of these musicians become absolute masters. They finish their degrees. They're phenomenal players, and there's nowhere for them to go. Because they've studied classical music. They can play Bartok and Rachmaninoff, but there's nowhere to play it and no one to play it with.
Oh, that's such a shame.
It's a terrible shame.
That's a terrible
shame. And here's the thing. So what do? They look to every possible avenue of playing, of using that skill. And one of the things they came across was classical adaptations. And really, the people who did it the best are ELP.
Definitely.
Pictures at an Exhibition. Emerson, Lake & Palmer's version of Pictures at an Exhibition outsold by 20-1 any classical version that ever got recorded.
By Mazursky. Oh, that's incredible.
Yeah. All right? So we sold, you know, I don't know what it is now, 3 million or something copies of Pictures at an Exhibition. No single version of that would have come anywhere near it. They're talking less than 10,000 probably.
Right.
20,000 copies. No, you know,
yeah.
Nothing. So the fact of the matter is, the students there could clearly see there was a potential if you knew how to adapt classical music to a modern, to be accepted in a modern genre, by
yeah.
a modern audience, there was a potential in that. And so they invited me to go down there and give a lecture about it.
Oh, wonderful.
Which I did, to the extent that I can, without Keith.
Right.
But what I did is I took my solo band down there, and we adapted a piece of Franz Liszt on the spot for them.
Wonderful.
Which was a fairly breathtaking experience, I have to tell you.
That's wonderful.
But it was not largely done by me. And just for the record, it was done by a man called David Arch, who's my MD and keyboard player in my solo band.
Wonderful.
An absolute genius. He plays piano for John Williams.
Ah, and you have that solo band is still functioning unit? Or?
Not really. It's, but it could be, and it would be if the right opportunity came, because
right.
we weren't together really for money or this and that. We just a fabulous band of people. We loved each other playing as musicians. Everybody got on a personal level. It was just a fun thing to do, really.
And I heard great things about those shows, actually, from people. So.
Well, you know, to be honest with you, it's David Arch.
Mm.
David's fantastic. You know, it was his band more than mine, really.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Great. I'm going to go back to the past a little bit, if it's okay with you.
Sure.
You made your first major musical breakthrough with King Crimson, and
yeah.
why do you think they were so innovative and, you know, unique, ahead of their time, really?
There was a number of things. I mean, one thing was that it was a moment in time, you know.
Right.
And it was timely in the sense that, you know, time marches on. And you get to a certain moment in history, and at that moment, it was perfect. The conditions were perfect.
Right.
For an innovative group of musicians to make a statement.
Yes.
The time was perfect.
I understand what you mean.
For an innovative group of musicians to make a statement, and there we were. We did not play the blues. We did not follow your traditional rock group influence. You know, in other words, at that time, the generally held tradition was to follow American music.
Right.
That is the blues, early rock and roll, country music, and so forth, and jazz.
Yeah.
What we did is we followed European music, which was classical folk, basically.
Yeah.
And to some extent, early big band, English big band music. And that's how that happened. And so we were very different. King Crimson was a very European band with no USA influence, really, when it started.
That's a great, great answer. And that's okay.
The European influence was where the classical stuff came from, and the use of strings and orchestral stuff. And so that was it. But it was a lot to do, I have to tell you, and I have to be honest. It was a lot to do with the time in which it took place.
Right, but that, to me, just ignore the beeping, there's a lot of people calling through. But that's what's, to me, just amazing about that period of music is that you did have such originality in so many different types of bands and so many different styles.
I often say in interviews that if you play a record from between 1968 and 1972, if you play any record in that period, within 3 seconds you will know who the artist is.
That's right.
You play, you only have to push the play button on a Jimi Hendrix record.
Yes.
It wouldn't take you and I very long to know who that was, or The Who, or The Moody Blues, or Pink Floyd, or ELP, or Yes, or any of those bands, really.
I agree.
They all, and now here's the thing, in order to make it at those times, there was a prerequisite, which was originality. That was the currency in those days, was originality. If you were original, then you had something to say. If you were not original, then you were just, a follower, really, and you were discounted. So the premium was upon being original. So bands had to be original.
Yes. And do you think the record companies had anything to do with that? Were they more allowing that to flourish?
Because then you had these wonderful visionary people like Ahmet Ertegun.
Yes.
Chris Blackwell.
Yes.
Island Records. Chris Blackwell discovered reggae music.
Yes.
U2, King Crimson, Joe Cocker, Chaffix, Steve Winwood. Yeah, there were these entrepreneurial bright lights. Robert Stigwood.
Mm. Yeah.
Who brought through Cream, the Bee Gees.
Yes.
It was a day of Svengalis. The day of Svengalis, when managers would conjure these mystical and original people almost out of a hat, And up would come Jimi Hendrix. Dear Lord, unbelievable. It was like a magician pulling something out of a hat that you just couldn't believe existed. The first time, I'll tell you what, the first time I ever saw Jimmy, I was supporting him. I was in the support act. And it was an absolute, on the way home, in the van, I was in a band called The Gods.
Yes.
And on the way home, it was absolute silence.
You were stunned.
There was not a word spoken. I mean, everybody was just terminally shocked because everything you knew up to that point had just changed because you'd seen a guy who was going to totally change rock music.
That's so incredible what you had to say. And he did it in silence.
Absolute fucking silence. Nobody spoke for 100 miles. They sat in the van and nobody said a word, but everybody was thinking the same thing, and that was, how did he do it? It was unbelievable.
And he did it in a short period in the scheme of things, from 1966 to 70 when he was popular, so four years.
But let me tell you something. Let me tell you the story. You didn't write this down, but I've got to tell it to you.
Okay.
I was playing a place called Brighton University. It's on the south coast of England. The Gods were supporting a band called the Jimi Hendrix Experience. And we thought it was a type of band that was one of those sort of bands that were sort of brass players doing soul music.
Uh-huh.
You know, where you'd have, like four brass players, drummer, two guitars, keyboard, and a singer out front, you know.
Right.
Maybe two backing vocalists.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a soul band, you know.
Yeah.
And we thought we were supporting the Jimi Hendrix Experience soul band. And we went on and played our set. We went down okay, you know, the Gods used, we're a good band, they went down okay.
Mm-hmm.
And we got off the stage and we cleared our gear off because we were our own roadies at that time, you know. And so the stage was bare and empty. And then we were ready to go home. And then somebody said, oh, why don't we go and have a drink, a pint of beer before we go, and maybe we'll watch the first song of the headliner. So we went up to the bar, and the bar in this case was overlooking the gymnasium in which this gig was taking place. And so there we were, sort of like a balcony view of the gym below us with, I suppose you're talking about 1,000 people, certainly no more than that, in this gymnasium. And we went up to the balcony and we got our pint of beer and there was still not a single soul on the stage. And as the minutes passed, the crowd started to become restless and they started to boo and stamp their feet and all the stuff. You know, it was getting a bit tense, you know, boo, like they wanted the next act on. All of a sudden, we saw this van drive up. It was like a one-ton transit, Ford Transit van. And a load of people jumped out, you know. And all of a sudden, a bunch of these roadies started to haul in Marshall cabinets. These huge guitar, 4x12 Marshall cabinets. And they put them up with two stacks of Marshall each side with a drum kit in the middle. And that was a very strange look to us. Because we were used to sort of different amplifiers spread around all over the stage, for one for this guitar player, one for the bass player, one for this, one for that, one for the sax guy.
Right.
But this was a very clean look, very sort of Spartan look. Two stacks of Marshall one side, two stacks of Marshall the other side, drum kit in the middle. By this time, the crowd, who were not impressed with equipment, you know, were really, they were booing loudly. Boo, piss off, go, you know. It was an ugly atmosphere. All of a sudden, in walks these three guys with two white guys and a black guy, and they had these afro haircuts, all three of them.
Right.
And they were dressed in this sort of weird military sort of gear.
Mm-hmm.
They got up on the stage, and either the audience went quiet because they were kind of weird to look at. And it was Noel Redding, Mitch Mitchell, and Jimmy. And nobody knew what to expect, you know. And then Jimi Hendrix started to tune up. Well, of course, tuning up wasn't done in those days. If you were professional, you walked on stage with your guitar in tune already. But Jimmy,
yeah,
coming from the blues world and playing with jazz, you know, you go up stage, you tune your guitar up on stage. Well, that wasn't done in England. So now the crowd started to really boo, right? And they booed and booed. And then Jimmy went up to the microphone. He said, look, I've come all the way from London. I'm really tired. I've just got off the plane. If you want me to play, then let me have a chance to tune up. If you don't, then I'm going to go home, right? And then they really booed like ferocious, right? So badly did they boo, they were kind of fronting him up, telling him to fuck off, right, go home. Right? And he opened up with Foxy Lady. And as I stood back there on the balcony, you know when you shake a blanket on a bed, if you shake your blanket and you watch a sort of wave go up the blanket, as you shake it, there's a sort of wave goes right up through the blanket, you know. This is what I saw in the audience. He started Foxy Lady and there was a wave of shock went through the audience. And I could see it go back through the audience as if it were a sound wave.
It's, yeah.
It hit them so hard, they literally moved backwards. And you could see a wave of shock go right through the audience, right underneath the balcony where I was standing. And Jesus H. Christ, I couldn't believe it. In the first song, he was biting the guitar with his teeth. And the playing was phenomenal. And he was playing both with his his hand overhand of the guitar and underhand, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
Above and below the fretboard.
Yes.
I mean, Jesus. I mean, it was just unbelievable. It was breathtaking, to say the least. And then, of course, he went on and he did Hey Joe and he did Watchtower and all this. I mean, people were just decimated.
Yeah. And
now you can extend, now you can understand on the way home in the van why we were all silent.
Yeah, that's it's a wonderful story. And people,
it is.
And people still feel like that today when they hear him. I mean,
of course,
hasn't faded.
Yeah, that's right. But you know, when you're there at the moment of inception,
yes,
you see it go down, you understand why 40 years later people are still hanging posters up, paying $500,000 for one of his guitars. You understand why?
Yes.
I understand why, because I actually saw it with my own two eyes. I actually saw Jimmy for the first time in England, and I saw him and the effect he had on an audience. I'm actually also very proud to say Jimmy was a big fan of King Crimson.
That's wonderful.
He used to come and watch King Crimson.
That's great.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, you're a lucky man, no pun intended. That's wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
I just want to...
That was the fantastic thing about those days. You know, everybody was everywhere.
It was so much happening, right?
So much happening, yeah.
At the same time.
I mean, there was a club in London called the Speakeasy. And you'd go down to the Speakeasy, and on any given night, you would see Procol Harum and... you know, you could see Elton John down there.
Great.
Yeah, people just milling around, Jeff Beck, you know. It was
incredible.
A sort of social club for the bands, and it was like that. And a wonderful time, really.
Wonderful. That's a great story. Wonderful. The first ELP album, it has a wide range of musical styles. You have Take a Pebble, but yet you have Lucky Man. What are your memories of working in the studio on the first album? Did it all come together naturally? The synthesis of the three of you?
No.
Okay.
I think really it is a band coming together where we were just funneling in all the influences that we had.
Right.
Lucky Man was a particularly strange story because we came to the end of the album, and in those days it was vinyl. You had to make a vinyl record, and there was time limit on each side. I think it was 21 minutes a side.
Right.
And we were short of three and a half minutes, and we had no more material, and really no more studio time left either. So I think it was Keith who said, you know, has anybody got any more ideas, you know, for like, what can we do for this last track? And there was silence. I mean, nobody had any ideas. And then I thought, shit, I mean, what are we going to do? Because if we got nothing, that's a big problem. So I said, look, I'll tell you what, I've got this folk song I wrote when I was a kid. Maybe it'll do, maybe just a filler, you know, but maybe he'll do, you know. And I played it to Keith, and he just couldn't, I mean, after what we'd been playing, which was quite intense, you know, the sort of big Bartok stuff, and powerful ELP keyboard music, it sounded like this naive folk tune, you know, and I don't think Keith could relate to it at all. And he said, I just don't know what I could play on it, you know. And I said, well, look, we haven't got anything else. We've got to do something. Why don't we just cut this? Even if it's a throwaway, it's at least it'll be something we can put on the album, and the rest of the album's great, so it ain't so bad. We'll be all right. So Carl Palmer and I played it. The first tracks that went down were acoustic guitar and drums. Mm-hmm. And it sounded dreadful. You know, and then I put a bass guitar on it. Then it didn't sound too bad, because, you know, all of a sudden, that hole in the middle between the drums and the acoustic was filled with this bass guitar. And because Carl and I had played the parts properly, when the bass went on, it sounded complete. And then I put another couple of guitars on, and then I started to sing, you know, and I did block harmonies, and by the end of the night, Keith came back from the pub at midnight, he walked into the studio, and it was a finished record, you know, it sounded pretty fantastic, had all these block harmonies on, it's pretty much as you hear it now.
Yeah, and he does a wonderful...
He said, Christ, that sounds great. He said, how did you do that? What did you do? And I said, no, we just built it up over the time. He said, I'd better play something on it, because I need to be on the record, right? So I said, why don't you put a solo on the end of it?
Yeah.
So he said, well, okay. I said, well, what can we do? And it just so happened that day we'd had delivered the new, brand new Moog synthesizer. And Bob Moog actually was there, and he brought it in, and he was they were just trying it out with Keith, and so he'd only just got delivery of it. So he said, "Hey, maybe I could try this Moog synthesizer out with it." And we said, "Okay, give it a go." And he went out there into the room, and I was in the control room with Eddie Offord, and Keith was out in the studio. And what he was trying to do, he was trying to work out this portmanteau effect. Do you know what portmanteau is?
No.
It's where one note slides up to another.
Okay, yeah.
You know, play a low note, boom, and it slides up, boom,
yeah,
to another, you see. And he was trying to work out the distance between these notes, how long it would take for one to slide up to the other. And that's how he was going to do the solo, using this portmanteau effect. So he said to me, he said, play the track and I'll see what I can work out. So I ran the track, and as Eddie Offord put it in play, I said, just record it in case he plays something good and we could catch it.
Mm.
And he put it into record, and that is the solo you hear now.
Ah, one take.
And what he was doing, he was trying to figure out the distance between the low notes and the high notes. And he goes, boom. You know, and that is how that solo went down.
That's wonderful.
And when we'd finished, he said, okay, he said, I think I've figured it out. Let's take one. And I said to Eddie, am I wrong, or was that great, what he just played? And then he said, I don't know, I think it sounded great. I said, I'll tell you what then, let's play it back. So he played it back. It was fucking phenomenal. You know, that was the solo that you now hear on Lucky Man. So I said to Keith, you know what? I think you've done it. And he wouldn't have it. He said, no, that was rubbish. He said, no, I can really do it. I've figured it out. I really have, you know. And I said, no, Keith, please come in and listen. He said, no, I can't live with that. That's shit, you know. I said, please, Keith, I beg you, come in and listen to it. It really is great. And eventually, he came in and listened, and it was phenomenal.
That's
the solo you hear.
That's a fantastic story. I mean,
even then, we thought it was a filler. We still thought at that point that the track was just there to fill up the time. It wasn't until the album was released in the States and it started to pick up on radio that we started to realize it was a huge hit.
Oh, that's wonderful. And that's a song you wrote at 12? Or something like
I
that?
I wrote it at 12 years old, yeah. And it's absolutely unchanged. I mean,
the lyrics?
The lyrics exactly as they were.
It's a lot of maturity at that age to me, at 12 years old.
I'm not sure it is, really.
Oh, okay.
When you think about it, you listen to those lyrics, I could see a child of 12 saying it. It's very much a fairy tale.
Yes. Yes.
It's a fairy tale, and I think really what it was just me. It was the first chords I ever learned on a guitar. You know, and so it was naive matched with naive. The lyrics were naive, the understanding of music was naive, but both well-intentioned, and both done with sincerity, I suppose I would use the word.
Right.
There's sort of sincerity about it. What made it hit, really, was the block harmonies on the chorus.
Yes.
It paid off so well. When it got to the chorus, you just cannot, you've got to hear it again, because you love it so much, you've got to play it again.
So that was your voice, that was your voice, the harmony, you were tracking your voice, double, multiple tracks, right?
Yeah, I'm the Beach Boys.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
That's a great...
Funny, it was funny.
I tell you, every story you're telling me is fantastic. You keep outdoing yourself. How did the ELP decide to do...
I'm only doing it because I was late, and I'm all upset.
I'm sorry, say that again?
I'm only doing this because I was late for your interview, and I felt guilty about it.
Otherwise, you wouldn't get these types of
Otherwise,
dances.
Otherwise, it would be over now, yeah.
Well, yeah, I have so much, but you let me know when, you know, you're tired or whatever.
That's all right,
I have to do something. I have a lot of stuff here, but... How did ELP decide to do the rock interpretation of Pictures at an exhibition? Was that Keith's decision, a mutual decision?
You know, Keith started it. He was practicing Pictures at an exhibition for himself. He'd learned it for himself. He started playing it, and basically it was nothing to do with ELP or ELP music. He was just playing it in rehearsals. When we got there, he'd be practicing Pictures at an exhibition because he liked it. And then what happened was, I used to play along with on the bass with him. So because, you know, he would keep playing it, and then I'd play along, and then there was me and Keith doing it. So the two of us would be doing it at the same time.
Huh?
And after a while, Carl used to join in. And so what it was is, every time we meet up for rehearsal, we kind of played more and more of this thing that Keith was playing for a hobby. And in the end, we learnt it all. I swear to God, we learnt the whole bloody thing. And, you know, then
Incredible.
We decided that it was actually something quite good that we maybe should try live. And so what I did then is I wrote the vocals for it.
Mm. Yeah.
Because up to then, we were just playing the instrumental version. But when we decided to play it live, I wrote the lyrics and we did the song parts for it, Great Gates of Kiev and all this.
Wonderful.
And then one night we decided to play it and we played it into the audience and they went crazy.
Ah, it's brilliant.
They went crazy. I mean, just out of this world. And we thought, shit, you know, well, let's try it again. And we tried it again and they went crazy again. You know, and every night we did it, they went mad. It was unbelievable.
That's fantastic.
And so, in the end, we went to Armin Oettingen and we said, we'd like to release, you know, we recorded the piece, in the end, we recorded it, and we wanted to release it as our next record, because we were seeing it go down unbelievably well. Armin Oettingen didn't want to release it, you know, he said, look, I think that, you know, you'll never get it on the radio. It'll never be played on the radio. And I think it's a mistake. You know, we can put it out on one of our sort of avant-garde labels, if you like, but I don't want to put it out on the Latin Records.
Wonderful.
So we said, well, we don't want it out on a non-such sort of avant-garde label. We think it's great. And what happened was that Chris Blackwell in England, the man I told you about earlier who discovered reggae music, he started to export Pictures at an Exhibition albums into America. In the first week, he sold 200,000.
Mm.
And Armin Oettingen, of course, went mad and instantly released it.
It's a great, wonderful...
Great story. You know, and of course, it went on to sell 3 million copies. But it was just one of those things. Of course, it looked unbelievable. You know, of course it looked like no radio would play it. But the truth was, that very afternoon, Scott Muni, WNEW in New York, played the whole side of Pictures and Exhibition back to back. Because those were the days that a DJ could afford to do what he wanted on radio.
Yes, I used to listen to Alison Steele at midnight would play, you know, also ELP or a Yes album side, or just incredible.
You know, I'll tell you something now. I know Alison. She's dead now, isn't she, Alison?
Yes, it's a shame.
Yeah. I knew Alison quite well.
Ah.
Very, very nice lady. And did a lot for ELP, of course. As did Scott.
As Scott. Know. Everyone misses Scott Muni.
I mean, they were great people. They're great people.
Yeah, they brought it to us, old music, and did it in such an incredibly just special way. Yes.
They're great people, great people. You know, a great man has just died. His name is D. Anthony.
Yes.
One of the great managers, one of the Svengali managers.
Yeah, I just heard about that, yes.
He was the manager of ELP in the very early days. Joe Cocker, Tony Bennett, the list goes on. Jethro Tull, Humble Pie, Peter Frampton in the end.
Wonderful.
Well, but he was a magical man, unbelievable character. Somebody who, you know, you know when people say, this guy walks in the room and the room lights up? You've heard that said.
Yes.
D was one of those people. You know, he would walk into the room, and the bloody room would light up. And I've seen it, you know, and that is just something that very few people actually have, is that business where, you know, they come into the room, and it's not like they're showing off or they're trying to be big time. Just the light... I'll tell you what it is. In life, some people are luminous, and some people are just reflectors of light.
Right.
Very few, rare, they're rare. These people are just luminous. They radiate light.
Yeah.
And most other people just reflect light, you know? And Dee was one of these people. He radiated light. You know, he came into the room. For some reason, he was just radiating light, you know.
And he wasn't doing it consciously. This was just
who he was.
Yeah.
There was a happiness about him. There was a light in his eye. There was, you know, I can't really put my finger on it.
It's wonderful.
It was just something that was so commanding. But it was a giving light. It was a shining, happy, creative, reassuring light. It wasn't a sort of ego light. It wasn't, look, I'm here, you know. It was just a happy, radiating happiness. And that's what he brought, and that's why he was a great manager.
And that transferred, and it also related to how he related to you in terms of management position, which isn't always the case.
So no.
That's wonderful.
No. He was one of the truly great, I would say, truly great managers.
I'll definitely put this in the interview. That's
you know,
fantastic.
I mean, there are a few of them. Robert Stigwood.
Stigwood, yes.
Peter Grant, I suppose.
Peter Grant.
Would have to go in there.
Yeah.
Brian Epstein, of course.
Brian Epstein, yes. Great. Wonderful.
But Dee was one of those people, you know, fabulous. I'll never forget. Do you want a story? I'll give you a story.
Sure, I love them, please.
I was the first time ELP played Madison Square Garden. This was the very early days, and I walked out to the backstage just before the show started, and I looked up at the audience, and it's an awesome sight. When you see 22,000 people in Madison Square Garden, it just is a fearsome thing. It is rather like the amphitheater in Rome before the gladiators come on, you know. It feels just like that because it's a fairly small arena, Madison Square Garden. It's just very tall.
Yes.
And I came to the backstage and Dee was with me, and I looked at Dee and I said, oh dear, look at that. I said, you know, oh, that's frightening, you know. And Dee said to me, he said, just remember, there's only one person out there. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, to each one of those people, they are just themselves.
Right.
They're looking up at you, and it's just them that's looking up at you. They can't see the other 22,000 people there. They can only see themselves and you.
That's right.
So he said, you are only playing ever to one person. Never forget it. I went back to the dressing room. I walked up on the stage with absolute confidence. And I sung my heart out just to one person.
That's Fantastic.
And from ever since then, from ever since that moment, I learned that lesson, and ever since then, I have performed only to one person. In my mind, it's to one person. No matter if it's 2,000 or 200,000, it's just one person I'm singing to.
So you're giving your all in any show, whatever the crowd.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic.
But the image I have in my mind, the feeling I have in my mind, is that it is one person.
Great.
Yeah, no more than that. Because otherwise it becomes very complicated.
Yeah.
I mean, where does it end, you know? In fact, to be honest, the hardest thing for me is playing in front of a small number of people.
Mm.
You know, if I play in front of 15 people, that's very difficult, you know?
Mm.
It's like scrutiny.
Because you notice their responses, or...
Well, they're looking they're looking right up your nostrils.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas when you look out at a huge festival audience, you're almost swimming with them, you know.
Right. Very, very true. I've read this. Was it a representation of the sort of the military-industrial complex, like the futility of war? Do I have this right?
To be honest, it was an image which was overlaid onto a musical concept.
Right.
In other words, it wasn't a concept that we had, that we wrote about something.
Mm.
If you see what I mean. The music was sort of surreal. And then, when we wanted an album cover, William Neal, who did the album artwork, designed that image as a response
Fantastic.
To the music.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, that's a great, great cover art for that one.
So,
yeah.
What you're seeing there is great cover art, and in a sense that, you know, that was his vision of what that music was.
Oh, excellent. When you recorded Trilogy, was there a conscious decision to record shorter tracks than the previous two albums?
When we recorded Trilogy, the main thing about it was that was just when 24-track recording occurred.
Ah.
So we got into overdubbing heavily.
Ah, yeah.
Then before then, it was pretty much you had to play everything right at the time. When Trilogy came, we started to overdub heavily. Problem then was, of course, we couldn't do it live, you know.
Yes.
There was that problem.
Yeah. Brain Salad Surgery. Did you think it would become such a landmark album at the time? You know, an album that people would look back on to this day?
Well, yeah, I mean, I suppose I did at that point because we were huge.
Right.
You know, I mean, you would, how could you not, you know? The band was huge, very influential, and I think, of course, we felt that, you know, of course it would have a big impact. What we were determined to do, however, was to make sure that it was, we could play it live.
Yeah.
That was the difference. We were determined that on Brain Salad Surgery, unlike Trilogy,
yeah.
We wouldn't be caught in that trap of recording something we could then not play live easily. So we made sure that we could play everything live on Brain Salad Surgery.
And Carnival 9, the 29, almost 30 minutes, was that constructed before the studio? Was that
What we did, I'll be honest with you, we bought a cinema. We actually bought a cinema to rehearse in London.
Mm.
And we set our gear up on the stage, and we decided that we would write and record this piece in the cinema live, so that we knew we could play it live when we went out on the road.
Wow.
And that's what we did. And we sat in there and we created the piece and we did it, you know, played it all live. And then we took it out on the road. And then we sold the cinema. That's what happened.
Great. Oh.
Those were the days, as they say.
That's wonderful. From 1974 to 77, a lot of VOP fans were wondering about the future of the band. There were always rumors about solo projects. And then Works Volume 1 was released, which to me is such a unique album because each of you performed solo works on the first three sides, if I'm correct, and the group performed together on side four.
You know...
Was that a way to embrace sort of a solo career while remaining in a band?
Yes, I think it was. I think when we got to Works Volume 1, I think we had basically burnt ourselves out in a way.
Mm.
We were burnt out. We toured too much, recorded too much.
Yes, I've heard this.
You know, basically, we wanted to make solo albums, but at that time, the band was worth so much money that nobody would let us just have time off to go and self-indulge.
Right.
And so there was a demand to keep making records, you know. And so the solution was to make solo albums within a global format. In other words, it would still be Emerson, Lake and Palmer together and separately. And so what you've got on Voice Volume 1 is three solo sides and a collective side, which is Pirates. Very nice record, I believe.
You mentioned Pirates?
Well, I'm saying the whole of Works Volume 1.
Yes.
It's a lovely record. Piano Concerto is fantastic.
It is.
I mean, with all the humility I can muster, I say that C'est la vie, Closer to Believing.
Oh, yes, I was going to
mention
that.
Very nice song. So, yeah. I'm just saying that I think the album was good, but it wasn't an ELP album in the sense that Trilogy or Tarkus or Brain Salad Surgery was.
It's funny you mentioned C'est la vie because I was going to say Closer to Believing is a lot of ELP fans feel is just a perfect song. One of the perfect songs you've ever written or performed. I'm sorry?
Well, I mean, Pete and I, who wrote it, we always say it's the best song we ever wrote in our lives.
Mm.
It took us, I don't know, Pete says 2 months. To me, it was like 3 months. To write.
Yeah.
We went back and back and back and back. And we just never stopped. It just was an endless writing process. It took us 3 months to write. And, I've just went on and on and on.
No.
And shall I tell you, the basis of it was, we decided, when we came to write it, that every line would have to contain a universal truth.
Mm.
Every line.
Okay.
And there were no near rhymes. They had to be perfect rhymes.
Okay, yes. Interesting.
Right? It wasn't as though you could rhyme, I don't know, red with bear or something.
Right, it had to be...
They had to be perfect rhymes. And so you'll find there is no... They are all perfect rhymes. And every line contains, and in fact, every phrase and every verse contains a universal truth.
Yeah,
from the opium of custom to the ledges of extremes, don't believe it till you've held it. Life is seldom what it seems. But lay your heart upon the table, and in the shuffling of dreams, remember who on earth you are.
That
was the thing. It was trying to capture this universal truth that was true for me, and it was true for you, and it was true for Pete, and it was true for whoever listened to the record. And that's what I think it is that some ELP people latch onto. They get it. They get it. They understand what it is.
Ah, that's great.
And it's not. There's not many. You know, I get. It's very funny, because I get guys come up to me and I say, I love that song from Closer to Believing. I say, oh, hello, you know. It's like another one joined the club. It's a very small club, but people some people really get it. They really got it. They really understood what it was about. And so Pete and I take a great pleasure when people do recognize it, because in a way it was not a hit. It wasn't a hit song or anything like big in terms of sales, but it meant a lot to us personally, you see.
That's great. Another great story. I just wanted to also tell you, many fans think that an artistic peak for EOP was Pirates, which, on the composition, you and Pete Sinfield contributed lyrics that, you know, have just great imagery, and your vocal interpretation is to me, masterful on that. What was that writing process like with Pete, and would you work again with Pete?
Oh, yes. You know, Pete and I are like brothers, really. We don't actually talk very much, but, you know, we really are as close as two people can be.
That's nice.
Sorry, what was the question?
Let me just find it here. Yeah, what was that whole writing process like for Pirates, really, with you and Keith?
You know, it started with Keith writing the music.
Uh-huh.
And I asked Keith, when he played me this idea that he had, which was more or less the start of Pirates, as you hear it now. And I said, what do you think, in your mind, what is it, you know? And he said, it's about mercenaries. And I thought, I don't like the sound of that, you know.
That's great.
I can't see a song written about mercenaries, really. They're not nice people. I mean, I don't even want to write about them. They're horrible, you know. And then I went away and I thought, well, the thing is, that's what it means to him, you know. It obviously must mean something to him in that sense. And I tried to think, and all of a sudden I came up with the idea, wait a minute, mercenaries, right? Then the music started to sound like the sea. I could hear the sea in the music. If you listen to the music, it sounds very oceanic.
Right.
It's rolling.
Because waves are not symmetrical, so to speak.
Right.
That's a great description. Yeah.
And I thought, fuck me, Pirates. Pirates.
That's great.
Because pirates are lovable characters. I mean, they're sort of romantic. It's a way of making a mercenary romantic. And so there it was. Flash.
Oh, that's great.
Pirates.
Ah, fantastic.
The captain rose from a silk divan with a pistol in his fist and shot the lock from an iron box and a blood-red ruby kiss.
You sound like a pirate there. Wonderful.
Yeah. All that beautiful imagery.
Yes.
And Pete and I, what we did is we bought every book, every film that was ever made about piracy, including the academic ones. I mean, I know more about, you know, piracy and the pirate code, as it were, which was more or less a democracy, actually. You know, we studied the subject from all angles. So we were authorities on piracy, Pete and I.
Great.
We became authorities on it. And we did this in Montreux, in Switzerland, in a chalet in Switzerland, which was bizarre. We were living up this mountain, a snow-capped mountain above the clouds, believe it or not, in Montreux, in Switzerland, writing about pirates in the Caribbean. It was bizarre.
Yeah, but it came out perfectly.
Day after day. But the thing is, we totally absorbed ourselves in it, you know.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
I have a few more. Works Volume Number 2 had I love watching over you, and of course I Believe in Father Christmas, which you did an orchestral version on Works Volume 2. What does the song mean to you now? Both of them, actually, Watching Over You, I Believe in Father Christmas.
I believe in Father Christmas was a song about Christmas. It wasn't meant to be a Christmas single or anything like that. It was a sort of, it was an observation of Christmas, what Christmas had become.
Right, the commercialism of it, or?
Yes.
Yes, that's interesting.
Just 1 second, please. It was a loss of the commercialism. It was the commercialism taking over from what is the spirit of Christmas that Pete and I grew up with as children, which was peace on earth, goodwill to all men, right? That's been superseded by buy this, spend more,
yes,
borrow more on your credit card, put yourself under more pressure, So we decided that we would write something about Christmas. It was a sort of protest song, really, about Christmas. It was never intended to be a single or a hit or anything like that. It was picked up in England as a Christmas single, and it became a big hit. That was the story on that.
Great description. And watching over you, was that for your daughter?
It was written really with my daughter in mind. It was written for my daughter.
The vocals are just fantastic on that.
And, yeah. Tell you the truth, she'd become, by the time I wrote it, she was older. But it was a kind of reflective thing. You know, when you reflect on your kid, they go through that age when she had just gone through, I suppose she'd become 4 or 5, and I wrote it when she was 6 or 7. Look, just give it to me and take the top off. Thank you very much.
Oh, please, take your time there, you know.
Yeah, that was it, really. I sort of wrote it retrospectively.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
By the time the Love Beach was recorded, did you know that ELP was about to call it a day or, you know, break up?
Yes.
You felt it?
Yes.
Okay.
We all did. And, you know, the fact was, we really didn't want to make the record.
Right.
But we were given a sort of fait accompli by Arnett that, you know, look, you owe us another record. If you want to have a solo career, you better make this album.
Right.
So there wasn't a lot of choice. I mean, we didn't really want to make it, but it wasn't as though we hated each other so much that we'd never worked together. It was just that we didn't want to make another album at that point.
Right.
I mean, we were all in agreement that we didn't want to make another album. It wasn't like one of us wanted to make it, the other one didn't.
Right, right, yes.
Nobody wanted to make it, you know. And we were kind of forced into it, so we did it. And what you're seeing there is ELP, not at its best, maybe, but still great.
Still
when
great.
When I listen back to it now, and I listen to Officer and a Gentleman, or...
I was just going to mention that, yeah.
They're all good pieces, you know.
Fantastic. Yeah, that's true. Following the original breakup of ELP, you made a couple of solo albums with Gary Moore was involved.
Yeah.
Was this a conscious effort to move in a different musical direction, or...?
Not really.
Okay.
When I left ELP and we all split up, really, to do our own things, I mean, not split up in a sense of busting up ELP, but just we wanted to do different things.
Yeah.
And I decided to make a solo up, and it was just an exploratory thing. I'd made some recordings with Toto,
Steve Lukather, the guitarist.
Steve, well, it was Toto, the whole band.
Yeah, the whole band, yes.
It was the whole band, and I did various things. It was a question of sort of finding my feet again. I was totally lost.
It must be a strange feeling, right?
I've just spent the last 10 years in this, you know, fantasy land with the LP. All of a sudden it was over, and you think, well, okay, I'd like to do something on my own, but what and how? And then so many things, it's like being the son of a rich and famous father.
Right.
You know, all of a sudden, well, you can't do that because the band you were in did that, or you can't look like that because... So all of a sudden, it becomes a very complicated path.
Yes.
And so what I did really is I wandered through the wilderness there were chance encounters. And Gary was a chance encounter. I wanted a guitar part played on one of my records. A friend of mine knew Gary and said, you should get Gary to do it. He's fantastic. So I said, that's great, get Gary down then, you know. And Gary came to Abbey Road, where we put the record before the Parda. He came in and he played, and we couldn't believe it.
No, he's a great guitar player.
I mean, he's one of the greatest players I'd ever seen in my life.
Yes,
And then Gary and I got talking and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, you know, I love guitar, and my life was really, I'm a guitar player.
That's
more
right.
More than I am a bass player, really.
Yes.
So anyway, Gary and I would start talking about guitar, and, you know, one thing led to another. And we decided to make an album, you know, and he came into my band, and we made a couple of records together. But really, Gary had a destiny. He really wanted to be himself, you know, quite rightly so. I mean, he is a great guitar player.
Yes.
And so he had this vision, I think, of going along that sort of blues path like Eric Clapton. But Gary, really, to me, is not a blues player. Well, I say that, he is. He's great. But the heart of Gary Moore is Irish.
Mm-hmm.
And when you really know Gary like I do, you know, there's an Irishness about his playing which is just breathtaking.
We played with Thin Lizzy at one point.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
And you never, I mean, when I say you never really hear the Gary Moore that I hear, but I mean, I have heard Gary playing things that he doesn't record that have just brought me to my knees. It was so beautiful.
You mean folk, has folkish elements? Or
Irish music, yeah.
It's very interesting.
So compelling and so emotional. And jigs, the you know, like Riverdance.
Yes, that's great.
I begged him. I said, Gary, for God's sake, make an album of this stuff. And he said, oh, one day I will.
That's
great. But he doesn't, you know.
Very nice. I have just a couple more. Following these solo albums, you worked again with Keith in Emerson, Lake and Powell. How was it working with the late Cozy Powell as a drummer? Was it a different, you know, feeling?
I think it was a different experience. It
yeah.
was, I would say, Cozy's a great drummer, lovely man, great drummer, but the chemistry wasn't the same.
Right.
The chemistry was not there with Cozy. Not because he wasn't a great player, not because he wasn't a lovely guy. It's just a question of that's the nature of chemistry. Chemistry isn't about anything. It's just about the fact that it happens to work with one guy and it doesn't happen to work with another, and you don't know why.
Right. And you knew that right away, or?
No. I mean, we played happily with Cozy, made a record with him, did a tour with him.
Yes.
Everything was fine. We really was. And he was a terrific player. But if you're asking me in retrospect about it, I have to say that, you know, the chemistry was not the same.
Very interesting. Very interesting. You were again able to work with both Keith and Carl on the reunion album, Black Moon, but the industry had changed a bit. You were signed to Victory Records.
Yeah.
You had a new producer, and you had produced so much of ELP, so...
Right. So
what are your thoughts today about that album, Black Moon?
Well, the Black Moon album was a great record, I think.
Yes.
And certainly Mark Mancina is a great producer, great writer, and a great friend of mine. You know, what happened was, Keith and Carl really wanted to try it with someone else. I'd produced all the previous records, and they wanted to try it another way, you know. And so I agreed to do that. I didn't want to be a producer dictator, and so I agreed to it. And we got the best producer that anyone could find. That was Mark Mancina.
Mm-hmm.
And he was sensational.
Yes, nice.
And just phenomenal. He wrote The Lying. Well, he wrote a lot of The Lying.
Yeah, yeah.
And many other things. Twister, the film Twister.
Yes.
He's a tremendous career in films.
Yeah.
And anyway, he was a great producer, a great fan of progressive music, understood progressive music, and was a great man. And I have to mention right now, as I do this, The other guy that was really key in that was a man called Steve Kempster, K-E-M-P-S-T-E-R.
Thanks for spelling these, by the way, because that always is a problem in interviews where I have to go back and I really...
You can't find it.
That's very, very nice that you're doing that, actually.
The only reason I do it is because these two guys were diamonds, right?
Yes.
They were big men. I mean, they were givers. They were the guys who made... I'll tell you what. I don't think they'd mind me telling you this. We would finish some records. Like, for instance, I'll give you an example. Farewell to Arms.
Mm-hmm.
I would look at Steve Kempster, the engineer. He would be sitting in silence, but there would be tears rolling down his cheeks.
Wow.
Now, you tell me about engineering, and that is the reason I take the trouble to spell his name out to you, because that's how much I respect him.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Not a word was spoken, just tears rolling down his cheeks. He'd given it everything. The record was phenomenal, you know, bang. And that's why I look on Black Moon like that. But you know something, it still wasn't the chemistry of the LP.
Right.
In fact, one day Mark Mancina was in the studio with me, because a lot of Black Moon was done separately, you know, whereas I would always record the LP together, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We always used to play together. I would go out, I would record a piece, I'd come in and listen to it, I'd go back out, I'd make some changes, we'd record again and blah, blah, blah. With Mark, you know, we were all out in the studio, he was in the control room. We would perform the piece, we'd come in and listen, and that'd pretty much be it. And one day he took me to one side, and he said to me, he said, Greg, let me ask you something. He said, how did you do it? And I said, do what, Mark, sorry? And he said, how did you make those early records? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, they were so, the arrangements were so impactful and so intense, you know. And I think what made that intense was this business of going in and out of the studio.
Mm.
And we would almost edit. You know, we'd do 10 bars. I'd come in and listen to it. And I'd go back out and say, yeah, that was great, you know. Why don't we edit it at bar 15, right? And like that, we'd go out to bar 15. And then we'll make the move, you know. So we used to record him like very small snippets. And I think that was part of the reason why the early ELP records were almost bespoke. They were almost manicured, block by block, almost 20 bars at a time, or 15 bars at a time.
It's like three perfectionists in a studio.
Well, because
really.
No, not so much that, but because I was producing and playing.
Right, right.
We would play a bit, I'd come in and listen to it, then I'd go back out, that was great, I was the mouthpiece, that was great, Keith, you played that great, Carl, you know, then I'd go back in again, we'd play it again, I'd go back in again, I'd listen. And so it was like that, and it just got to be very intense. And I would use the word compartmentalized. Mm. that, you know, that was the difference. And when we made the record with Mark, I think it was a producer's vision of ELP,
oh,
as opposed to being ELP.
Great.
And when we worked with Keith Olsen on the Hot Seat...
I was just going to ask you about that. It was just funny.
Right, well, it was, you know, Keith Olsen was the producer of Fleetwood Mac.
Yes.
And I think what Keith's vision was is hit singles. You know, and he's great, don't get me wrong. Keith Olsen's very, very top producer. Really, really good. Knows his stuff. My goodness. You know, but ELP wasn't a singles band.
Right.
And so what Keith Olsen tried to do is everything ELP wrote, he tried to turn it into a hit single.
Yeah.
And it didn't work. I mean, there's some good little ideas there, but no, you know, it didn't really, nothing really evolved. It was as though they were all the embryos of ideas that were turned into singles that didn't work, you know.
I was going to ask you about Daddy, which has a relationship to a charity of interest to you.
Yeah.
Why did this charity become so dear to your heart? And I just happen to love the song too, but...
Well, it was simple. I was living in Los Angeles at the time, and I was watching a program called America's Most Wanted.
Sure.
And up came the story of Sarah Ann Wood. This young little girl, 12-year-old, 13-year-old girl, had been abducted and raped, killed in upstate New York. They'd never found her body. And the story was her father, in the middle of winter, was out in the middle of the wilderness in the Adirondacks searching for her body.
Yeah, it makes me want to cry. It actually, there can't be anything worse than that, right?
Well, here's the story. So I saw the program. It was absolutely heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. And he was trying to raise funds to keep the campaign going to search for her. And this was the line. He came onto the TV, and he had some volunteers there that were with him. And they were really hardy old souls. You know, they're out in the snow. They were making tea for the people who were looking for the body. And they interviewed him, and they said to him, this was the killer, right? They said to him, what is it that makes you be able to stay out here in sub-zero temperatures and look for your daughter? She's been dead. We know she's been dead because they found the murderer, right? And he confessed to the crime, and then he recanted on the confession. So they know they had him, and they knew she was dead, and he would not tell where the body was buried. So so the Reverend Wood, Sarah Ann Wood's father, kept looking for her, right? They knew roughly where the body was. And anyway, so they interviewed him, and they said, how do you manage to keep this vigil up in the middle of winter like this? And he said, and this was the killer, he said, it's as though I could hear her calling to me. She's saying, Daddy, come and bring me home.
Yeah, and that's incredible. Yes.
Fuck.
Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah.
Daddy, come and bring me home. You know, and that was the song. And it haunted me, because I've got a child of my own.
Sure.
It haunted me, and for a couple of nights I couldn't sleep. I kept rolling, I kept thinking, God Almighty, how must he feel? Daddy, come and bring me home. He's got this, his daughter's calling in his mind. And then I wrote the song to exercise it out of my mind. And then I thought, there's got to be something good I can do with this song. So I donated the royalties to his cause, and that's how I actually went on America's Most Wanted. With John Walsh.
Yes.
And we tried to encourage people to be aware of that problem. There are these 10 rules you have with child abduction. You know, it's like, never let your child walk to school on their own. Always make sure they're walking at least in pairs.
Yes.
Children don't get abducted in pairs, they get abducted in ones, you know.
Right. It's a shame.
And there were rules like that. And so I went around the country, and I got on the radio stations, and I played the single. I said, please buy the single, send the money to this charity, and then I would take phone calls, you know, afterwards, and the fucking phones would light up. It was unbelievable. The phones would just go white. They'd immediately, every line would light up. And then I would answer the phone lines, and there would be women crying on the line. They'd be saying, I feel so bad, and, you know, I let Tommy walk to school on his own. I'm a bad mother. I know I am, and blah, blah, blah. And I'd have to say, no, you're okay. Look, it's not your fault. Don't worry about it. It's not, look. I'm sure, you know. And of course, it was upsetting people so badly. I had to stop it.
Mm-hmm.
I had to stop it because people were just getting really upset by it. They'd hear this story, and they'd allowed their kid to walk alone to school. They felt bad and blah, 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 and all this. And of course, then, in every city, you've got somebody who's actually got a missing child. And they would come along and see me. You know, our child is missing. Could you please do something like that for our child? And so every city I was meeting these parents of lost children. And of course, I mean, every day I was in tears with him.
Yeah.
It was grueling. It was grueling, you know. And so I did about a month of it. I don't know how much we raised. $30,000 or $40,000, I think, for the charity. And that was it. That was my brush with that, really. The very strange, difficult thing, very upsetting thing, very hard to actually do anything about.
Right.
You know, how do you stop someone from abducting a child and doing that? Well, I don't know, really. Just be careful is the one thing if you're a...
Exactly.
And on the other side of it, how do you stop people actually wanting to abuse children? I'm damned if I know, because I'm damned if I know what you want to do it in the first place.
Yeah, but it's a very noble thing you did, getting involved in that. Very, very
nice. I'll be honest with you, the only noble thing about it was that, and they told me this at the National Center for Missing and Abducted Children in Washington, is that generally celebrities don't like to be associated with the missing children thing.
Right.
It just leaves a bad taste, and I think most people would rather be doing cancer, or they'd rather be doing this, or they'd rather be doing children in Africa, or, you know, something that sounds better. It doesn't sound very good. And so the upshot of that is they don't get enough support, you see?
Yes, yes. Great.
Not enough money goes to it, because not enough celebs get behind it, because it's just not one of those things that sounds very good.
Right, it doesn't become the cause of the day, so to speak.
Correct. Yeah, that's right.
Very, very interesting. I just got one or two more, and I'm going to... You've been so forthcoming and wonderful.
That's right, yeah.
Really,
yeah.
Really.
That's okay.
I'm
just about running out now.
No, I am too. I have to... yeah, no, you've gone beyond the call of duty.
That's all right. No, I'm happy to do it for you.
Thank you so much. Now, is Keith's arm or hand okay? Is everything okay with him physically at this point? Do you know that?
Yeah, he went through... Yeah, he does have this... I don't know what they call it. It's a condition that he's got.
Right.
But he's going through therapy with it.
Good.
And I think it's something that was, I think it's sort of stress related, or, you know, where he practices so much that his brain just started to overrun, in a sense, and lost control of his fingers in a way.
Mm. Incredible.
You know if your brain can trigger your finger to tap. You know, if you tap 20 times, you know, your brain is telling you to tap 20 times.
Yeah.
But you try and do that faster and faster. At a certain point, you will overrun. And you will tap out of time, or you won't count properly, or the one will become the three. You see what I'm saying?
Wow.
And that's what happened to him, is that, you know, his brain had just overrun. Because he plays so fast and he rehearses so fast that in the end, I think that's what happened. And it's probably a question of, you know, calming down and just stopping for a moment. And the other thing is therapy. You know, he's obviously talked to all kinds of, you know, medical people about it. They got him on certain things and he's working away at it, so I play with him, and I can't, you know, I can't see anything.
Oh, great.
But obviously he can, you know. There are some things that he has difficulty in playing, and but he's working on it, and it seems to be fine. It's working, and he's still recovering. But
great.
It was a shock to him and
sure.
to all of us, because when your hands go, as a composer, a pianist, you know,
sure.
It's the worst of all things.
Yes, the last one. So, with the writing of the new music and the High Voltage Festival, what should ELP fans expect? I mean, should they be expecting something?
I really hesitate to to make any long range predictions.
Okay.
But my hope is that ELP will be able to come and play for the world at least one more time.
I love it.
I'd like to do it, and I know Keith would. and I hope Carl too. So, you know, it's something that we're trying to organise. We've certainly organised this first date in London.
Great.
So I think it's a question of getting down. If we all do that and that goes well, then perhaps we'll do some more. And I think that's really where we are.
Okay. I just want to tell you, it's been a personal and professional thrill for me to speak to you, really. And
yeah,
so forthcoming. Sorry?
No, I'm very happy it was, and very nice to talk to you, too.
Yeah, and you were so forthcoming. Your stories are wonderful, just everything. And I really appreciate it so much. And I'll get in touch with Ellie when this is going to be on the site. And thank you so, so much.
It was a real pleasure. I'm sorry I missed you earlier.
No, no, no problem at all. Thanks again for the time. I mean, you took a lot of time. I really appreciate it.
Okay, God bless. Good night.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.